And thus, a social innovation is a new way to solve a problem through the use of social relationships. The key issue is not the nature of the problem, but the nature of the solution. For example, the desire to talk to faraway friends and relatives is a social problem, and it can be solved technically by inventing a telephone, or socially by passing messages through friends. Similarly, the desire to walk with a broken knee is a technical problem, and it can be solved socially by having your friends assist you, or technically through the aid of crutches. When these solutions are novel, they are social or technical innovations. When these solutions are repeated or borrowed from others, they are social or technical solutions, but not innovations. Asking for help is a social solution, but it's not a social innovation, unless it's the first time it ever occurred to you to ask for help. If you consider the greatest inventions in human history, it becomes obvious that many of them are social. For example, one of Homo erectus' most important inventions was division of labor and the resultant social coordination. By dividing up tasks and working together as a group, Homo erectus were able to hunt massive animals with the simplest of tools. Division of labor made groups more than just the sum of their parts, and thereby played an outsized role in making us the success story we are today. Despite our much briefer time on the planet, Homo sapiens have created exponentially more technical inventions than Homo erectus did, and we have devised countless social innovations as well. For example, although love of money may be the root of all kinds of evil, money is an incredibly useful social innovation. The physical object itself is trivial. What is important about money is the social convention by which everyone agrees on its value. After division of labor, money may be the second most important social innovation in history. Money can be used to acquire anything of value, and thereby enables all sorts of market exchanges that would be nearly impossible if people were required to trade in goods. Imagine the inconvenience of going to the mall to buy a new sweater and bringing along a pig or goat with you as barter. In the world before money, that's how people shopped. If division of labor is our most important social innovation, and money comes in second place, what's next? My choice for third place might sound odd, but I'd be inclined to put waiting in line next. I never gave much thought to the social innovation of waiting in line until I found myself in a situation in which lines didn't exist. I was trying to cross an international border that allowed only foot traffic, and I was coming from a rural area that apparently had no conventions about waiting in line. There were several dozen fellow travelers trying to get their passport stamped by one person in a tiny booth, and not a single one of them waited in line. As I surveyed the swirling mass of humanity enveloping the customs booth, I was reminded of the BBC special Planet Earth, in which emperor penguins huddled together in Antarctica in a giant penguin blob in their effort to stay warm. Contemplating this human blob, I could feel my heart sink in my chest, and I wondered if I should change my travel plans. But I had to cross the border, so I chose a random spot in the blob and joined in, trying to edge closer to the booth whenever possible. A couple of times I came heartbreakingly close, only to have the current change direction at the last minute. Sometimes I moved forward with surprising speed, and sometimes I moved backward. After what seemed like an eternity squeezed into this sweaty and dusty mass of my fellow travelers, and just as I was wondering if I should, or even could, extricate myself from the blob and try again the next day, an eddy in the human current plunked me right in front of the booth. I thrust my passport at the harried customs officer, and it seemed like my lucky break, until the crowd started carrying me off while he still had my passport. Out of desperation, I grabbed the plywood counter with both hands. The customs officer slipped my stamped passport between my fingers just before my feet left the ground and I lost my grip. Since then, I have regarded the practice of waiting in line as one of the world's great social innovations. Money and lines are ancient inventions. But the internet has recently enabled all sorts of social innovations that our ancestors would have loved. Everyone has a favorite, but I regard social media and dating sites as some of the most important social innovations on the internet. Keep in mind that the distinction between social and technical innovations is continuous rather than dichotomous. For example, Facebook is an incredible social innovation, but it's also a remarkable technical achievement. Thus, it's closer to the middle of the social-technical continuum than waiting in line, a purely social solution to the problem of who gets to go next, or the light bulb, a purely technical solution to the problem of unwanted darkness. When I was young, there were basically three ways to meet your life partner. You could hang out in places where your partner was likely to be found, you could be set up by mutual friends, or you could put a personal ad in the back of your local newspaper, in which you listed your height, weight, and age, and provided a 4 or 5 word blurb about why someone should choose you. Newspaper photos were expensive and of poor quality, so people simply claimed to be attractive and didn't bother to include photos in these ads. My guess is that the hit rate for this method of finding a partner was incredibly low, and it certainly didn't have a reputation as a great way to meet Ms. or Mr. Right. Social networking and dating sites have moved us a million miles beyond that world by offering specialized places for people with particular interests or backgrounds, by allowing people to learn a lot more about each other before they bother to meet in person, and most notably, by massively increasing the number of potential partners people can meet. If dating is a numbers game, and I suspect it is, the internet plays a critical role by helping people find their needle in the haystack. Social networking and dating sites get a ton of traffic, and research shows that romantic partners are increasingly likely to meet online. For example, a study of nearly 20,000 people who married between 2005 and 2012 by John Cacioppo of the University of Chicago and his colleagues found that over one-third of them originally met online. Although the study concluded in 2012, 7.7% of those who'd met in person had already separated or divorced, while only 6% of those who'd met online had separated or divorced. That might seem like a small difference, but every percentage point in the offline sample is equivalent to another 125 broken relationships. Furthermore, if we compare the 4,000 people who met on social network and dating sites, the two most common online meeting sites, to the 8,000 people who met at work, through friends, at school, at a social gathering, or at a bar or club, the five most common offline meeting points, we see reliable differences in marital satisfaction. None of these samples who met offline was as satisfied as the online samples, although those who met at school or a social gathering came close. Couples who met through friends or at a bar, in contrast, were least likely to be satisfied in their marriage. These data suggest that relationships that begin online may be more likely to last than relationships that begin almost anywhere else. To turn to social media more broadly, there are numerous instances of the value of Facebook, YouTube, and Snapchat. For example, although the Arab Spring hasn't worked out very well yet, Facebook played a critical role in helping relatively powerless individuals coordinate massive protests against totalitarian regimes across the Middle East. Facebook may be ubiquitous and occasionally of great societal importance, and it has helped me reconnect with friends from high school, but my favorite example of the power of social media is YouTube. When I was a kid, gatekeepers held the keys to almost every route to fame and fortune. If you wanted to be a movie star, someone had to decide that you were star material. If you had an idea for a new type of TV show, someone had to decide that your idea was entertaining. YouTube eliminated these gatekeepers in one fell swoop. Now anyone with a computer and an idea can start putting up videos for the world to see. YouTube has demonstrated that gatekeepers have a very limited sense of what people really want. The most compelling evidence I know for this claim is the incredible popularity of YouTubers who film themselves playing video games. It never would have occurred to me that people would want to watch other people play video games. But one afternoon, I heard yelling from my son's room and asked if he was all right. It turned out the yelling was coming from the YouTube channel he was watching, in which people were playing video games and yelling at their screens. In case you think this is a fringe market, as of this writing, PewDiePie is the king of this genre with more than 54 million subscribers. To put that number in perspective, The most popular TV show in America in the 2015-16 season was Sunday Night Football, with an average weekly audience of 22 million. When I Googled PewDiePie's audience over the last month, he had 147 million views, substantially more than the 90 million views of Sunday Night Football each month. Almost every video he puts up has millions of viewers, who make him a fortune from advertisements, and his videos are a lot cheaper to produce than a football game. PewDiePie is far from the only success story on YouTube. Various other YouTubers make a living demonstrating different techniques for putting on makeup, kidding around about bizarre conspiracy theories, offering life hacks, and even just showing scenes from their daily lives. And there are no age barriers, as a few small children make huge sums of money just opening presents and playing with them. What I love about the most successful channels on YouTube is how unappealing they are to most adults. None of the most successful YouTubers would ever get past the security guy at a talent agency, much less an actual talent agent, but they clearly resonate with their target audience. Social media has democratized the route to fame and fortune, and in so doing, has filled vast unmet entertainment needs. For example, to watch people pop their pimples or lovingly unbox sneakers. The social innovation hypothesis. So how do we explain why some people innovate new products, but most people don't? If humans evolved to solve their problems socially rather than technically, that doesn't mean that everyone will choose a social solution every time. Rather, we should be able to use this hypothesis as a starting point to predict who will innovate new products and who won't. An obvious place to begin such a search is with the prediction that people who are less social should be more likely to innovate technically. Not only do less social people have smaller social networks and thus fewer people to turn to for assistance, but many of them also find social solutions less rewarding and reliable. As a consequence, less social people should be likely to orient themselves toward technical solutions to their problems, a proclivity that would lead to a greater rate of technical innovation. If we conceive of social and technical orientations as somewhat unrelated traits, then we would expect people to lie in one of four quadrants, defined by their technical and social orientations. Quadrants 1 and 2 contain those people with a strong social orientation and either a strong or weak technical orientation. Meanwhile, quadrants 3 and 4 contain people with a weak social orientation and either a weak or strong technical orientation. Given how critical social functioning was to our ancestors' success, most people are found to possess a strong social orientation. We would expect those with relatively weak technical skills to innovate socially. The key point is that those who have strong technical skills also innovate socially rather than technically. For most of us, social engagement is fun and rewarding, and ever since we left the trees, it has been our default orientation toward the world. This observation holds for introverts, too. Almost everyone likes to socialize. Introverts just prefer to socialize less often and with a smaller circle of closer friends. As a consequence, highly social people who have the talent to tinker with objects are relatively unlikely to do so when confronted with a problem. For example, it might be easy enough for some people to wire a can opener to their toaster and an oven timer to create an automatic dog feeder for when they're out of town, but even people as handy as that would typically prefer to ask a friend to come over to feed Fido while they're away. Thus, the social innovation hypothesis predicts that most people are unlikely to innovate technically. Of the relatively few people who reside in quadrants 3 and 4, only those who have a strong technical orientation would be likely to innovate technically. So even if technical skills themselves are relatively common, the ubiquity of human sociality would make technical innovation a relatively rare occurrence. It is very difficult to test these possibilities with ancestral data, but two pieces of modern evidence support the social innovation hypothesis. First, one way of quantifying sociality is to look at the frequency of autism. People on the autism spectrum vary in intelligence, but regardless of their intellect, they struggle with social relations. Impaired social functioning is one of the hallmarks of autism. Even highly intelligent individuals with autism have problems with theory of mind, as their brains don't automatically compute the intentions and feelings of others in the manner we discuss in Chapter 2. As a result, people with autism don't understand neurotypical people very well and struggle to engage them socially. Given these facts, it's no surprise that you rarely find people with autism working in sales, and they are also rare in the humanities and social sciences. In contrast, people on the autism spectrum can be readily found in fields in which the dominant orientation is toward objects and away from people, such as engineering and the physical sciences. For example, Simon Baron Cohen of Cambridge University and his colleagues found that autism is more common in the families of physicists, engineers, and mathematicians than in the population in general. When Baron Cohen and his colleagues went on to develop a scale to quantify levels of autism, one of their first comparisons was between students in the sciences and those in the humanities. They found that science students had higher autism scores, including reduced levels of sociality, than humanities students, and this difference was most notable among students studying physical sciences, computer science, and mathematics. Students in the social sciences scored no differently from students in the humanities. Engineering students in this sample had scores that fell between those in the physical sciences and those in the humanities. Unsurprisingly, engineers and physical scientists are also more likely than people in the humanities and social sciences to hold patents or to innovate technical products for their own use at home. In other words, among engineers and physical scientists, there is a preponderance of people who possess a strong technical orientation and a weak social orientation, and thus are likely to innovate technically. As a notable example, Silicon Valley is a hotbed of innovation and also features an unusual concentration of people on the autism spectrum. Autism rates fluctuate by time and location, an important but poorly understood fact in and of itself, and it is no easy matter to pin down the exact rate of autism in the large and somewhat amorphous Silicon Valley. But a study by Baron Cohen and his colleagues compared the Silicon Valley of the Netherlands, Eindhoven, where 30% of the jobs are in the IT sector, to two similarly sized Dutch cities, Utrecht and Haarlem. They found that autism rates were 23 per 1,000 people in Eindhoven, but only 6 per 1,000 in Utrecht, and 8 per 1,000 in Haarlem. Of course, such findings are not evidence that sociality is preventing people from innovating technically, as proposed by the social innovation hypothesis. But the fact that sociality and technical innovation appear negatively correlated raises the possibility that one influences the other. As a second approach, we can look for sex differences in innovation. It's always dicey business investigating differences between the sexes, given the widespread tendency on both sides of the aisle to extrapolate well beyond the data. But please, bear with me through this discussion, and I think you'll see that the implications make perfect sense. If we take the plunge into this literature, despite the obvious risks, we find that one of the most substantial and widely replicated sex differences in preferences is the tendency for men to be more interested in objects, and women to be more interested in people. For example, this result was confirmed in an analysis of vocational interests of more than 500,000 men and women from the United States and Canada. No doubt, such sex differences in interests are partially a function of sex-typed cultural expectations, but research suggests that they are also partly innate and appear to be culturally universal. Many studies document sex-typical differences in toy preferences that are evident in infants in their first year of life, for example, trucks versus dolls. And the male preference for toy trucks has even been shown in monkeys. Regardless of whether these differences are driven by cultural expectations or biological differences, or more likely both, the social innovation hypothesis suggests that sex differences in sociality are likely to lead to sex differences in technical innovation. Consistent with this possibility, professions that are oriented toward technical solutions, for example, mathematics and engineering, not only boast many more people on the autism spectrum in their ranks, but people in these professions are also predominantly male. An enormous body of cross-cultural research shows that women typically have stronger verbal than spatial skills, and men typically have stronger spatial than verbal skills. So the fact that men are overrepresented in math and engineering might reflect nothing more than sex differences in ability profiles. We're naturally drawn to things we're good at, and we tend to improve in domains that interest us. So the causal order of these sex differences in abilities and interests is hard to pin down. Women are more interested in people, so perhaps they communicate with one another more and become more verbally skilled. Men are more interested in objects, so perhaps they spend more time manipulating them, which fosters better spatial reasoning. Or perhaps the causal order goes the other way, or both ways. Whatever the origins, it's important to keep in mind that male and female spatial and verbal abilities overlap more than they differ. The key finding, however, is that even among men and women who have strong mathematical and technical skills, men show greater interest in objects and women show greater interest in people. For example, David Lubinsky of Vanderbilt University and his colleagues selected a sample of over 1,500 mathematically precocious students across the United States and followed them into adulthood. By the time they had reached middle adulthood, men from this sample were more than twice as likely as women to hold a patent. More important for our purposes, sex differences in social interests matched the sex differences in technical innovation. When asked about their work preferences, the men in this sample were more interested than the women in working with things, for example, computers, tools, and inventing slash creating something with impact. In contrast, the women were more interested than the men in working with other people and having the results of my work significantly affect other people. Similarly, the women were more interested than the men in time to socialize and strong friendships. Thus, even among mathematically gifted men and women, notable sex differences emerge in their social orientation and technical achievement. These sex differences in social orientation also predict whether people choose a career that involves technical innovation. The clearest example of such an effect can be seen in a longitudinal study by Ming-Te Wang of the University of Pittsburgh and his colleagues, with another national sample of approximately 1,500 students. Based on the students' SAT scores, Wang separated students who had high math and high verbal abilities from those who had high math but only moderate verbal abilities. Several important differences emerged between these two groups of students, despite the fact that they were all great at math. First, Wang found that the high math, high verbal group was two-thirds female, whereas the high math, moderate verbal group was two-thirds male. In other words, women who are mathematically gifted tend to be smart across the board, whereas a lot of men are great at math science and not much else. This turns out to be important because people who are gifted mathematically and verbally reported greater interest in working with people and less interest in working with objects than those who were great only at math. Wang also found that students who were great only at math were much more likely to go into a career in the physical sciences and engineering than students who were smart across the board. These career choices matched their earlier stated interests. The more they were interested in working with people, the less likely they were to choose a career in physical science, and the more they were interested in working with things, the more likely they were to choose a career in physical science. These findings are important for several reasons. First, they suggest that women's underrepresentation in math and the physical sciences might not be a problem in the classic sense that it signifies barriers against women in such fields. Many people have interpreted female underrepresentation in math and science as evidence that women are made to feel unwelcome in those fields. There is evidence on both sides of this issue, but Wang's data suggests that gender stereotypes and a potentially hostile climate are not the primary factors keeping most women out of these fields. After all, women used to be rare in the biological sciences as well, which they now dominate at both the undergraduate and graduate levels. Presumably, the climate was no more welcoming to women in biology, or the numerous other fields in which female participation soared, than it was in math, engineering, and the physical sciences, where female participation has risen much more slowly. Rather, Wang's findings suggest that most people who are talented verbally as well as mathematically are not terribly interested in becoming physical scientists and engineers. Because women who are good at math tend to be smart across the board, they vote with their feet and choose other careers. This result makes perfect sense to me, as it reminds me of my own career choice. Like one-third of the men in Wang's study, I have a female typical brain and that my verbal abilities are stronger than my math abilities. When I was in high school, I considered becoming an engineer and even took the engineering entrance exams for college before I realized that math and building things didn't interest me as much as a people-oriented career in the social sciences. It's important to remember that I had the luxury of making this choice because I grew up in a wealthy country where people can make a perfectly good living with a liberal arts education. Notwithstanding the old joke, how do you get a psychology graduate off your porch? Pay for the pizza. In contrast, in poorer countries where most of the good jobs are in technology and science, people who are good in math and science tend to follow this career path. This difference in career choices that emerges as a function of the overall wealth of a country leads to an interesting and counterintuitive effect. Poorer countries are typically less gender egalitarian than wealthier countries. But women are more likely to enter the sciences in these poorer, less gender egalitarian countries than they are in richer and more egalitarian ones. If sexism or cultural mores about what women should do were keeping women out of science as was once the case, this result is the opposite of what we would expect. In contrast, if underrepresentation of women in math and science is now largely a function of gender differences in interest leading to gender differences in career choice, then this result is exactly what we would expect. Engineering, math, and the physical sciences may simply not be very interesting to the majority of people who are socially oriented and have other options. Indeed, it's possible that sex differences in college graduation rates will prove to be a much bigger problem than sex differences in math and science participation. Since the late 20th century, women have been more likely than men to graduate from college in the United States. On the one hand, you could view such statistics as righting a historical wrong, given that women were once prevented from attending some of the best colleges. On the other hand, women rarely marry less educated men, so differential graduation rates might cause relationship problems for the foreseeable future. Because marriage is good for men and unmarried men are bad for society, this sex difference in education may lead to all sorts of individual and societal disruptions. Because women tend to be more oriented toward people and less oriented toward objects, the social innovation hypothesis suggests that women's innovations will be less likely than men's to be targeted at technical solutions. The data are largely consistent with this possibility. For example, in a sample of nearly 10,000 patents granted in six European countries in the 1990s, less than 3% were held by women. Cultural and historical factors that disadvantage female inventors assuredly play a role in this figure, but it is noteworthy that the percentage of female patents in that sample is four times lower than the percentage of female engineers, approximately 12%. Similarly, in a representative sample of nearly 1,200 people from the United Kingdom, 8.6% of males and 3.7% of females reported that they engaged in technical innovation by creating or modifying products for their own purposes in their own home. These data suggest that even when the formal constraints, biases, and barriers involved in patenting are removed, the ratio of male to female technical innovators is still greater than 2-to-1. Even though technical innovation is rare for both men and women, men innovate new products more often than women do, both formally and informally. According to the social innovation hypothesis, the fact that men are overrepresented among inventors is not evidence that women are less inventive, but rather that women's sociality leads them to innovate elsewhere. Because there is virtually no research on social innovation, the possibility that women are more socially innovative than men remains an untested hypothesis as of this writing. Contrary to the widespread belief that inventors are a rare breed, the social innovation hypothesis clarifies that almost all humans are innovators, but most people direct their inventive capacities toward social rather than technical solutions. Humans don't innovate every day, but that's only because we don't have to. Our shared cultural knowledge provides ready-made solutions to most of the problems we face. However, we are capable of innovating whenever we encounter a novel problem that is of sufficient importance to compel us to solve it. In contrast to Melissa and the other chimp mothers, nearly all humans would be able to innovate a solution to the problem of psychopaths in their group if there were no law enforcement. Necessity is often described as the mother of invention, but different people perceive their necessities differently, and it is the rare problem that demands a technical rather than a social solution. We can invent a trap to deal with murderous cannibals, but we can also enlist the aid of other members of our group who have been victimized by them to arrive at a novel social solution for eliminating the threat. The capacity to innovate novel solutions appears to be universal in our species, but the proclivity to direct this capacity at technical rather than social solutions appears to be unusual. With just a little technical training and experience, nearly all healthy adult human minds are capable of creating technical solutions if the situation demands it. In the absence of such demands, technical innovation might be rare, even if the abilities that underlie it are universal in our species. People who are interested in people, i.e. almost all of us, simply don't invent very many new things, regardless of their potential to do so. Finally, although our inherent sociality might disrupt our tendency to invent new products, it plays a major role in transforming one person's invention into everyone else's solution. The human success story is not just one of innovation. It is also one of transmitting new inventions to others who use and improve them. Technical problem solving might be less frequent due to our incredibly strong social orientation, but sociality itself is critical for spreading technical innovation. The irony is that Homo sapiens rose to worldwide dominance due to our hypersociality, but it may be the relatively asocial ones among us whom we have to thank for the technical inventions that so differentiate our lives from those of all the other beasts on this planet. Chapter 7. Elephants and Baboons: The Evolution of Moral and Immoral Leadership. Nelson Mandela is one of my heroes. In his early 40s, he was sentenced to hard labor for his efforts to overthrow the apartheid South African government, and he remained imprisoned until his late 60s. It's easy to imagine that he would emerge a broken or embittered man, and yet, after he was released from prison, he became a force for democracy and racial reconciliation. Mandela easily won election as South Africa's first post-apartheid president, but after one term in office, he chose to step down rather than seek re-election, which he would have won just as easily. Mandela was as close to a saint as any politician I've ever seen, and certainly one of the great moral leaders of our time. Robert Mugabe, of neighboring Zimbabwe, provides a sharp contrast to Mandela. Mugabe was also imprisoned for his role in trying to overthrow an apartheid government. Also like Mandela, Mugabe expanded social services and called for racial reconciliation when he was newly elected as prime minister. But the similarity ends there. When Mugabe faced internal competition from domestic opponents, instead of compromising with them as Mandela had done, he resorted to violence to consolidate and extend his rule. Rather than stepping down after his first term, he orchestrated constitutional amendments that made his role more powerful and allowed him to run for repeated and rigged re-elections. His policies devastated his country, leading to hyperinflation, unemployment, widespread disease, and food shortages. Mandela and Mugabe shared a similar background and might have been motivated to act in similar ways. So why didn't they? The contrast between them raises the question of what prompts a person to become a moral or immoral leader. I couldn't have predicted the direction that either man would choose at the outset of his political career, and many people took far too long to condemn Mugabe because they couldn't believe what he had become. Although Mandela and Mugabe represent extreme examples, the psychological forces that created both men can be found in all of us. The hypersociality we evolved to survive the vanishing rainforest suppressed our individualism, but did not extinguish it. As a consequence, humans are a blend of self-serving and group-serving. On the self-serving side, evolution acts on individual organisms to maximize their inclusive fitness, the number of offspring they and their relatives successfully place in the next generation. As we saw in Chapter 4, to attract a mate, people need to compete with others in their group, and thus any trait that helps people outcompete fellow group members will tend to be magnified in the population due to its impact on sexual selection. This evolutionary pressure toward individualism and competition is met by the countervailing pressures placed on us by our role in cooperative and interdependent groups. We were successful on the savanna and everywhere else, despite being small, slow, and weak, because we evolved the capacity to work incredibly well as a team. For this reason, teamwork and cooperation are highly valued in potential friends and mates, and our collective orientation benefits us individually by helping us gain coalition partners. People who are self-focused and uncooperative are less desirable, particularly as romantic partners, and hence sexual selection ensures that cooperation also remains common in the gene pool. The tension between individualism and collectivism underlies human sociality and all our interactions with our fellow group members. This tension is exacerbated in the context of leadership, as the costs and benefits of group membership are magnified in our leaders. On the one hand, leaders depend upon, exemplify, and facilitate the group orientation that teamwork demands and that has made us so successful. Mandela's suffering on behalf of his people and his subsequent willingness to stake his reputation on inclusiveness and reconciliation are examples of this sort of group-serving orientation. On the other hand, power brings benefits, and the benefits that accrue uniquely to group leaders are likely to nudge them to consider their personal and nepotistic desires ahead of their group's needs. Mugabe's willingness to starve his own people to consolidate his power and wealth is an example of this self-serving orientation. The resolution of this tension between group and self-orientation determines the morality of leadership. Moral leaders are those who act in their group's interest and benefit from their decisions only to the degree that their group benefits. For reasons that will become apparent, I refer to such moral leaders as elephants. Immoral leaders are those who act out of self-interest and who benefit from their decisions at the expense of their group. I refer to such immoral leaders as baboons. Elephants and baboons. Adult male elephants are formidable beasts. With few, if any, natural predators, adult males choose to live either alone or in somewhat fluid groups of other males, and thus long-term elephant groups are composed exclusively of adult females and juvenile males and females. In principle, the strongest male elephant could impose himself as leader over the herd, but there is no incentive for him to do so. Their widespread plant food sources are not readily monopolized, and females announce their fertility to all males in their vicinity, so males must compete for sexual access whether they are in the group or reside kilometers away. Thus, elephant leaders are typically chosen from among the oldest females in the group, and this matriarch is relied on to coordinate group movements, migration, and responses to threats, such as lions. The leader's role in these situations is to call the other elephants to action and direct them toward threats or opportunities. She doesn't dash out in front to provide protection. When threatened by lions, all the adults position themselves in front to protect their young. Nor does she suffer privations on behalf of her group. The leadership she provides is in the form of guidance. Because leadership does not give her preferential access to food sources or mating opportunities, elephant leaders do not gain unique benefits from their position. Rather, good leadership in elephant groups provides equal and mutual benefit to all members of the group, and thus everyone in the group is motivated for the wisest elephant to lead the group. Group interests and individual interests are nicely aligned in this system, so elephant leadership is predominantly group-serving. Baboon leaders sit on the other end of the continuum. As I discuss in Chapter 1, savanna baboons are preyed upon by hyenas and large cats such as leopards and lions. For this reason, there is safety in numbers, and male and female savanna baboons live together in large groups. Although baboon troops rarely have leaders in the sense of an individual who provides guidance or protection to group members, males compete fiercely for dominance over one another. Females inherit their position in the dominance hierarchy from their mother, but males leave the troop of their birth to join another troop, so they must rise through the ranks by dominating other members of the troop through continual threats or acts of aggression. Because the alpha male typically provides no guidance to the troop, the goal of dominance over other baboons is entirely self-serving. The benefits available to other males, for example, access to fertile females, preferred foods, and shady resting spots, are impossible to monopolize, but they are disproportionately taken by the alpha male. It is clearly not beneficial to other members of the baboon troop to be dominated in such a manner, but they are largely unable to prevent this outcome. Traits such as large physical size and aggression have evolved in baboons because they facilitate dominance of the troop, which in turn provides reproductive opportunities that permit these traits to flourish. One takeaway from the contrasting leadership styles of elephants and baboons is that the distribution of resources matters. Similar to the predictors of territoriality discussed in Chapter 3, baboons have a greater incentive to dominate their fellow group members than do elephants. With regard to food, the inability of herbivorous elephants to monopolize the abundant plants they require contrasts to the situation of omnivorous baboons. The relative scarcity of high-calorie foods, particularly meat, available to baboons imposes strong evolutionary pressures on dominance. Baboons compete fiercely for high-quality food, and control over food sharing allows baboon leaders to buy and maintain allies, which can be critical to maintaining alpha status. Perhaps more important, differences in opportunities for reproduction also contribute to the type of leader that emerges. In part because elephant leaders are female, they experience no reproductive advantage as a consequence of their role. In contrast, approximately half of the reproductive success of male baboons is accounted for by their rank in the hierarchy, as dominant baboons have access to more mates than do subordinate ones. This difference imposes strong evolutionary pressure on male baboons to achieve a dominant position within the troop. Disgruntled troop mates can either challenge the alpha or try to join another group where they might be more successful. Either way, the troop provides protection and more eyes to detect predators, so non-dominant males prefer group living over trying their chances alone. Elephants and baboons as leadership styles. Most human leaders are a blend of group-serving and self-serving, but people vary dramatically on where they fall on that continuum. Some people are mostly group-serving, like Mandela, and others are mostly self-serving, like Mugabe. An elephant-type leader maintains a group orientation under most circumstances, but baboon-type leaders are very sensitive to threats to their leadership, and they will shift between self and group orientation depending on internal and external threats. The clearest example of such situational shifting among human leaders can be found in the work of John Maynor of Florida State University and his colleagues. In one set of experiments, Maynor demonstrated that when baboon leaders, i.e. those high in dominance orientation, feel that their leadership position is threatened by subordinates, they limit information sharing with their group and exclude talented members at a cost to group performance. Maynor found that baboon leaders also rely on the tried-and-true strategy of divide and conquer when they feel their leadership position is threatened by talented team members. Such leaders try to prevent group members from bonding with one another. The immorality of this leadership strategy is underscored by baboon leaders' efforts to exclude and isolate the most talented individuals. These actions place the leader's goals in direct opposition to the group's goals. More important, these immoral leadership behaviors disappear when baboon leaders are assured of their leadership position, again providing evidence that baboon leaders know how to enhance group performance, but choose not to do so when their own stature is at risk. This sort of self-serving and group-harming behavior is a hallmark of baboon leaders across the globe, as countless despots have impoverished their people in their efforts to ensure that they remain at the top, of an ever-diminishing heap. These immoral leadership behaviors disappear when baboon leaders find their group in competition with other groups. Under such circumstances, baboon leaders rally round to act in their group's interest because group and leader goals, even baboon leader goals, are brought into alignment by the fact that failure in intergroup competition can be very costly. Among our hunter-gatherer ancestors, a loss in intergroup conflict could lead to extermination of the entire group, or more commonly all the males in the group, with the females captured, enslaved, and eventually incorporated into the other group. For this reason, we evolved a propensity to set aside our differences when competing with outside groups, to focus our energy on supporting our own group. Again, this sort of behavior can also be seen in despots around the globe, as many modern dictators began their careers as freedom fighters who often risked their lives and livelihood to remove the dictator or colonial leader who preceded them. But once such leaders are successful and intergroup competition is removed, baboon leaders place their own interests ahead of their groups and focus on consolidating and maintaining their power rather than serving their people. Followers play a critical role in enabling baboon leaders under such conditions. As is discussed more thoroughly in Chapter 8, deadly intergroup competition is a challenge that humans have faced for at least as long as we've been Homo sapiens, and it has shaped our psychology to accept and even prefer more dominant leaders during times of intergroup strife. A kind or indecisive person might be a good friend, but such an individual would be a hopeless leader in the face of a mortal enemy. Some elephant leaders rise to this challenge and change their leadership style to suit their situation, but some are simply too democratic for the demands of intergroup conflict. As a consequence, our leadership preferences change in the face of conflict. These psychological responses to within and between group competition represent adaptations to group living in a species that shows substantial cooperation within groups, but often ruthless competition between them. A case study, the Hadza and the Yanomamo. The Hadza are hunter-gatherers from Tanzania. This may have no relevance to their lifestyle, but the Hadza live in the cradle of humanity, on the same East African savanna where our ancestors were expelled from the trees. They live in relatively small and fluid groups of an average size of 20 to 30 people who set up temporary camps for a few weeks or months at a time. The Hadza typically move to a new location when the local waterhole dries up or they have exhausted nearby resources and must travel uncomfortable distances to gather foods. Due to their nomadic lifestyle, the Hadza own only as much as they can carry, so the sum total of their individual possessions is limited. Men usually own some jewelry and clothes, bows and arrows for hunting, and a few knives, axes, and such for setting up camp. Women also own jewelry and clothes, as well as digging sticks and cooking pots for gathering and cooking food. The Hadza make all group decisions through discussion and have no explicit leaders. Older men and women are given a degree of deference, but do not actually lead, and individuals who try to dominate others quickly find themselves shunned. Because individual Hadza can change groups at their own discretion, would-be leaders have little power to enforce their will over other people. The Hadza are relatively peaceful for a society with no law enforcement. They are also monogamous, and a couple is considered to have married when they set up house together. In his survey of childbirths, the superb ethnographer of the Hadza, Frank Marlowe of Florida State University, found that men average 4 to 5 children each, with a range from 0 to 16. The Yanomamo are hunter horticulturalists who live in the Amazon basin of Venezuela and Brazil. Their villages also move on occasion, but because the Yanomamo do a fair bit of gardening, growing cassava and other foods, they move much less frequently than the Hadza. As a consequence, their domiciles are more permanent structures, and people tend to own more implements. Their villages also grow to a much more substantial size than those of the Hadza, sometimes containing more than 300 individuals. Most people prefer to live in smaller villages that are closer to the size of typical Hadza camps, and for the same reason that the Hadza prefer smaller groups, they lead to less bickering. The headmen in the smaller villages tend to lead by example rather than force, and life in small Yanomamo villages isn't that different from life in Hadza camps. Nevertheless, some leaders wield a great deal of power and prevent their groups from splitting apart, despite the wishes of their group members. Part of the motivation of such leaders is that many of the villages are in a near constant state of war with one another, and larger villages have an advantage in these conflicts over smaller ones. Many leaders among the Yanomamo are despotic and cruel. Such leaders hold group members in sway through the threat of personal violence and typically rely on a network of male kin as their power base. Conflicts are commonly resolved through ritualized forms of violence. If there is a minor dispute, people arrange side-slapping and wrestling contests. For the side-slapping contests, the disputants line up in two different groups. Members of one group raise their arm in the air, and members of the other group slap them on the exposed side of their body as hard as they can. The roles then reverse, and this plays out until everyone is sore and tired. At this point, the dispute is regarded as resolved, and people go about their business. If there is a major dispute, the Yanomamo arrange the most extraordinary ritualized club fights. As in the side-slapping contests, people on one side of the dispute stand still while those on the other side inflict damage, and then the roles are reversed. In this case, person A stands with his arms by his side, while person B smashes a 10 to 15 foot pole down onto the top of A's head as hard as he possibly can. Person A may or may not crumple to the ground unconscious, but if he does, the next member of A's group stands in as a replacement and clubs person B in a similar fashion. This serial clubbing continues until all the members of both parties have been knocked unconscious or have decided that the grievance has been resolved. If a dispute arises between members of different villages that is too serious to resolve by clubbing, then a series of deadly tit-for-tat raids between villages ensues. Sometimes these raids end with a mutual feast as the groups resolve to put the past behind them, and sometimes they continue interminably. Yanomamo are polygynous, often with little female choice, as powerful males have systems of trading their female kin with one another to obtain wives. Wives are frequently treated very poorly by such men, who physically abuse them at will, often in public and with no intercession from other group members. Violence appears to be an important route to obtaining leadership positions and wives, as men who have killed another man, termed unokai, have more wives than men who have not murdered someone. Commensurate with their greater number of wives, unokai also have more children than men who have not killed anyone. Such differences in reproductive success provide an incredibly strong incentive toward violence and the baboon leadership that exists in some Yanomamo villages. Indeed, some Yanomamo leaders have huge numbers of children, and their remarkable ethnographer, Napoleon Chagnon of the University of Michigan, documents one powerful leader as having 43 children and 229 grandchildren. Given the high child mortality rate among the Yanomamo, this is an extraordinary outcome. Inequality and the emergence of baboon leaders. Why are Hadza leaders, to the degree that such leaders even exist, primarily peaceful elephants, while Yanomamo leaders are often despotic and violent baboons? No doubt many factors are involved, but the opportunity to monopolize resources appears to play an important role. Reminiscent of ever-grazing elephants, people in nomadic societies such as the Hadza encounter fewer opportunities for accumulating and controlling resources than those in more sedentary hunter-horticulturalist societies such as the Yanomamo. When resources can be controlled and used to leverage deference and compliance from others, it gives rise to the more competitive and self-serving aspects of our psychology. As we saw in Chapter 3, the shift from hunter-gatherer societies to more settled horticulturalist practices was a critical point in the move away from egalitarianism and toward despotism in many human societies. One important aspect of a horticultural lifestyle is the capacity to afford more than one wife. Yanomamo men who have killed another and are high in the dominance hierarchy often have many children through multiple wives, but this is not possible for immediate return hunter-gatherers. Hadzemen simply cannot hunt enough animals to support more than one wife. And even if they were epic hunters, they would be required to share their catch with the rest of the group, with limited opportunities to preferentially feed their family. Monogamy and female choice among the Hadza contributes to an elephant leadership style, whereas polygyny and lack of female choice among the Yanomamo contributes to a baboon leadership style. Indeed, the potential for polygyny plays a critical role in shaping the morality of leaders across a wide variety of societies. Polygynous societies are often criticized for their poor treatment of women, as can be seen among the Yanomamo. But women in some polygynous societies, such as the Sukuma and Rangi of northern Tanzania, are treated perfectly well. Women in such societies benefit from the greater wealth of their husbands. They and their children are typically well looked after, and hence they often choose to be second or third wives of wealthy men rather than first wives of poor ones. In contrast, as Robert Wright points out in The Moral Animal, poor men are always the losers in polygynous societies, as they spend their lives alone, unable to afford a wife. The enforced equality of Hadza society, with hunters required to share their kill and show humility, people owning few possessions, and reproductive success spread relatively evenly across society, means that there is little to be gained through despotic leadership. Not only do efforts to dominate meet stiff resistance from others, who have equal access to resources and are not dependent on would-be leaders, but there really are no additional resources to be garnered by such a strategy. Rather, wise counsel can help the group be more successful, and all individuals benefit to the degree that their group benefits. Indeed, to the degree that individuals gain anything from offering their leadership during group decision-making, it is through increased prestige by demonstrating wisdom and compassion. Thus, leadership in Hadza society can be obtained only momentarily and situationally, and the goals of would-be leaders must necessarily align with those of their group. The inherent selfishness that is part of human nature and the inherent group orientation that is also part of human nature are aligned by the egalitarian structure of Hadza society, and both push people toward elephant leadership. In contrast, the Yanomamo marriage systems create the potential for substantial inequality. This inequality rewards men for their dominance and status-seeking, as wives are obtained in part through violence against others, particularly other groups, and in part through alliances that can be more readily controlled by those in leadership positions. As a consequence, violent and despotic leaders have greater reproductive success than nonviolent individuals and people who are not in leadership positions. In this manner, the structure of Yanomamo society causes our inherent selfishness to oppose our inherent group orientation. This motivational tension results in a leadership style that varies both with circumstance and with the personalities and proclivities of individual leaders. Particularly in smaller villages, group orientation is common, and leadership is often elephant-like. But because Yanomamo society has the potential for much greater inequality, a self-serving orientation is also rewarded, and the resultant leadership can be baboon-like, based on dominance over others rather than helpful guidance. From small-scale societies to large-scale corporations. If we jump from forager societies to corporate America, we see many of the same inequality-based dynamics. Modern corporations are typically structured in a manner more similar to the Yanomamo than the Hadza, and as a result, they incentivize baboon leadership. For example, the average CEO salary in the largest American companies was $9 million in 2017. It's no surprise that competition for such a paycheck can be fierce. Nor is it a surprise that baboon leaders are particularly motivated by the enormous status, power, and financial reward of being a CEO. I don't mean to suggest that all corporate CEOs are baboons, or that really well-paid CEOs are necessarily baboons. Indeed, there are many notable examples of elephant leaders in the corporate world, some of whom are very well remunerated. But there are far too many corporate and political baboons, despite the fact that employees, shareholders, and voters would prefer it were otherwise. And the goal of this chapter is to discuss the psychology that underlies this unfortunate situation. Although followers want to select elephants to lead them, baboons usually pretend to be elephants until they get the job. Baboons also win followers by promising to bring them along on their quest for dominance. As Donald Trump repeated during his campaign, "We're going to win so much, you'll be